And the court will proceed to the second case of the day, Bethel All Nations Church et al. Versus the City of Chicago. Ms. Hornstra.
May it please the court. Bethel's complaint in this case seeks the return of title to property that was awarded to the City of Chicago by the Circuit Court of Cook County in an action brought to enforce the Illinois Property Tax Code. There are just a couple issues that I want to touch on this morning. I will first explain that Bethel's claims were outside the district court's jurisdiction because they're barred by both the Tax Injunction Act and the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. I'll also explain that even if this court disagrees and determines that the district court did have jurisdiction, Bethel had no likelihood of success on the merits because its claims were untimely. Thus, either because of a jurisdictional defect or because of the statute of limitations, it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to enter a preliminary injunction barring the city from exercising ownership rights over the property, property that is owned since 1998, and the district court's order should be vacated.
Ms. Hornstra, there's a piece of this that's troubling to me. The city tried to give notice of an application for a tax deed. And that notice came back as undeliverable.
Correct.
And then when the city had the sheriff try to serve notice, the sheriff came back and said, sorry, we couldn't serve the notice because the address doesn't exist. Right?
Correct.
Are you saying that there was no further investigation, that no one said to themselves, gosh, maybe we have the wrong address?
The record doesn't disclose this. The record in federal court doesn't disclose what, if any, investigation was undertaken about that. In state court, when Bethel challenged this, one of the things that the attorneys for the city noted was that frequently, a tax properties, the actual address of the property that's subject to a tax sale is different than the address of the owner. These properties are frequently vacant and no one is there. Certainly in this case, when you look closely at the fact that one was sent to West 63rd Street, one was sent to East 63rd Street, it looks like it warranted a further follow-up investigation in this case. But at this juncture, that was what Bethel was attacking in the state court proceeding.
When did the city learn that it had sent notice to the wrong address? When does the city learn this?
The return of service that one of the notices came back undeliverable was in the prove-up hearing. It was in the file. The city had it.
I'm asking for a date.
So in 1998. Back before the tax deed was issued. But certainly this was what Bethel was presenting in the state court proceeding when it sought to vacate the tax deed. The city had pointed out in the state court proceeding that, of course, this was one of multiple notices that's required by the property tax code to be served. And there was another notice that was filed with the Cook County clerk, addressed to the correct address that the clerk was required to send, and that was properly addressed. But the more fundamental problem with the district court's order here is that Bethel's suit raises serious questions about the district court's jurisdiction to award the relief, whether or not Bethel had proper notice of the tax deed proceeding or not, because the source of Bethel's alleged injury was a state court order issuing a tax deed. First, the Tax Injunction Act is implicated by this suit. That act prohibits district courts from enjoining or restraining the collection of state or local taxes.
I want to ask you a question about that before we get into your argument. Let's suppose that a class of churches files an action in federal court claiming that a small town is cracking down on churches by scrutinizing their tax-exempt filings more carefully than other nonprofits and was trying to put the squeeze, let's say, on religious institutions to run them out of town. Would a federal court lack jurisdiction to hear this suit because of the Tax Injunction Act?
I think so. If what they're claiming was, we're going to be subject to more taxes, they're trying to lessen the amount of taxes that would be collected by the suit. And, you know, there are a number of cases talking about what a drastic remedy the Tax Injunction Act is. And so while, that's my view just based on that hypothetical that the tax injunction would bar that suit. And, you know, whether or not that seems, you know, unfair or difficult, the tax injunction is very broadly drafted, and has been applied as sort of a drastic remedy to limit federal courts' interference with any efforts by a state to collect taxes. And here what we have is Bethel's effort to set aside a deed that it was issued in this tax proceeding. And under Illinois law, the use of tax sales and tax deeds as a means of enforcing taxes is an integral part of state and local tax collection efforts. And here, when the county acquired the interest in the property, it was to substitute for the unpaid taxes and then assigned the interest in that property to the city, who was one of the taxing districts. As this court's decisions in Wright versus Pappas and RTC Commercial Assets makes clear, undoing the result of this tax sale would undermine that system of enforcement. So the only question, which I'd like to just address in a moment, but first briefly address Rooker-Feldman, is whether Bethel had an opportunity in state court to address that. That's the same concern under Rooker-Feldman, which precludes jurisdiction over suits brought by state court losers complaining of injuries caused by state court judgments. And here, Bethel, it's very clear that the source of its injury is the Illinois court's order issuing a tax deed to the city, and it's that judgment that Bethel seeks to set aside. And so the only question remaining, we think, under either of these bars to federal jurisdiction, and this is the basis that the district court invoked for deciding these weren't applicable, was whether or not Bethel had an opportunity to seek the relief that it's seeking in state court. But in fact, it was not for any lack of opportunity that Bethel failed in state court to raise its allegations that it didn't have proper notice of the tax deed before its entry. Rather, when Bethel came to state court, and of course Bethel moved in 2003 under Illinois state procedure to attack a judgment after it's been entered under Section 214.01 to vacate the tax deed, it was, of course, many years after the tax deed had been entered. And so the state court judge hearing this position specifically pressed Bethel to explain why it waited until April 2003 to seek relief from a tax deed entered in 1998.
Then let me ask you this. Suppose, because you're now in 2003, and I want to go back to 2002 for a minute, because suppose that despite the clear language of the May 20th, 2002 letter, the one written by Mr. Quinn.
Ms. Quinn.
Yes. I'm sorry, Ms. Quinn. The city made, despite that the city made very different representations in the in-person negotiations. And was that Mr. Bowen?
That was Bishop Jackson made some testimony about Bowen.
Right. So it was Mr. Bowen, the in-person negotiations and meetings that took place. Might that not give the church the idea that the city was taking one position officially in writing, but was taking the unofficial position that it would do everything it could to give the property back? Do you understand?
I understand that Bishop Jackson's testimony was that that Bethel got one understanding from what Bowen was saying. But and at that point, I mean, back to 2002, the city was not actually hadn't moved for possession of the tax deed. But what the city's letters, to the extent that Bishop Jackson, testified that he didn't get some of these earlier letters. It's unclear whether he would testify that he got these later letters. But the city made clear in those letters that the basis for its willingness to cooperate in the church's efforts to set aside the tax deed was based on the church's claim that it never should have paid taxes, that it was fully exempt. And what the church needed to do, and apparently had said that it was going to do, was obtain an attorney to represent it, to go back to the Illinois Department of Revenue to try to obtain a declaration that it was fully exempt, because the certificate that the Department of Revenue issued in 1999 said you have a resale shop, so you have to pay some taxes.
Can I go back even further? Because and you might be the wrong person. I might want to ask Mr. Norman this, but I was just wondering if you know, does the church maintain that it never received the properly addressed notice that was purportedly sent by the county clerk in at the end of December of 1997?
Bishop Jackson, I believe, in the district court hearing on the preliminary injunction hearing, said he never that they never knew anything before the taxi was entered, that they never got any notice of it. Now, when Bethel was in state court in the 214-01 petition, though, they didn't advance that argument. They didn't say, I mean, for one thing, they didn't say we didn't have an opportunity to get in here within 2 years to file a timely 214-01 petition. But they also never advanced the argument that the notice that was sent to them or the efforts that were made to give notice were so deficient as to violate their right to due process.
You mean the 22-5 notice?
Correct. Correct. In fact, Bethel's counsel in the state court hearing, when the circuit court judge pointed out that, you know, there was this 22-5 notice, it was properly addressed, it looked like it had been properly served, counsel said, you know, I don't make any argument on it. Their focus was really on the 22-10 notice. I'm sorry for using these, you know, numbers, but that notice went to the wrong address, and that because the city sent it to the wrong address but then said that all the notices were properly served, that was fraud. And that, according to Bethel's counsel, the theory was, you know, that could be brought at any time, that we don't have to tell you why we didn't come on time.
You're talking about Bethel's counsel in the state court now.
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct. That's correct. And so the version of the facts that Bethel advances now as a basis to seek relief in federal court, that it didn't know anything about the tax deed before it was entered in 1998, that notice was so deficient that there was a due process violation, and then that it didn't know about any of this in time to bring a timely petition under state court proceedings, just wasn't told. I mean, they had an opportunity, certainly, to tell this to the state court judge hearing this. The state court judge was asking for, you know, some, you know, basically Bethel came in late. The state court judge was asking for a reason for why that was, so that it could determine whether it still needed to hear Bethel's claim on the merits. And Bethel, for whatever reason, wasn't willing to offer the version of facts that it now offers in the state court. And so the idea that Bethel didn't have an opportunity because of the 2-year time limit under 214 is just not supported by the record of what happened in state court. And in fact, had Bethel made that argument and said, we just learned out about it, because according to what Bethel says now, it learned about the tax deed in April 2003, came in June 2003. Bethel said, we just found out about it. And not only that, but there was, you know, notice was so deficient there was a due process violation. Even though it was late, the Illinois state courts would have been obligated to consider that. There's no the Illinois courts, you know, of course, are obligated to and do enforce the due process clause. The judgment couldn't be enforced against Bethel if it had been entered in violation of due process. But Bethel just didn't present that claim, and it didn't offer an excuse for filing it. It's late. And there's, of course, nothing unique about the state applying that 2-year time limit to bar Bethel from bringing the claim. Of course, it's the same 2-year period that applies to 1983 claims in this court. And so, essentially, Bethel had an opportunity to raise these objections to the tax deed in state court. And because it had an opportunity, because there's the Tax Injunction Act statute and the doctrine under Rooker-Feldman precluding jurisdiction, the district court simply didn't have jurisdiction to enter the preliminary injunction in this case.
Can you tell me how Illinois law works in this area? I'm confused about this, but certainly if it's a church, it's going to be exempt. Now, I don't see that there's any real dispute here. Maybe they didn't do all the proper filing and that sort of thing, that it was a church and was operating as a church for most of its activities. Now, there's this claim that it was doing some selling or something.
That's what the Illinois Department of Revenue determined.
In addition to that. So how would that normally be handled if a church a church gets a 100% total exemption, or does a church get an exemption for part of its operation but is taxed on the non-religious aspect of what it's doing?
That from the Illinois Department of Revenue's determination from 1999, that appears to be what it was. I don't know exactly how the percentages are worked. If you know, you have an assessed value of a certain amount for a property, and then you say 20% of it is used for commercial activities and 80% religious. But I would assume there's some kind of breakdown along that. But
I've never been in a church, temple, whatever, that didn't have a little gift shop.
You know, I think if those, I don't know exactly how the determinations are made of what's taxable and what's not. You know, I think if there's not a profit or if it's all related to church activities, then it's not taxable. I think
sure.
The view here was that this was just, there were, you know, it was furniture and rugs that were being sold. Yeah,
but see, that's the trouble with this case. This is if this is, and apparently the city doesn't dispute that this was a church, and it's in a poor area, and they do a lot of supposedly good things here. It just doesn't seem right that the city should come in and take over this operation because they hadn't filed the proper papers that they would have to file to get an exemption. And then you have this, I don't know, what's this, Bowen fellow who's kind of a liaison to the community, and he's going to try to work with them to figure all this out.
Well, I appreciate your concern, Judge Evans, but what the record reflects is that, of course, the city has owned the property since 1998, and the reason it didn't seek possession until 2003 is that it saw this problem and wanted the church to take action to, and I understand the concern about not filing the proper paperwork, but it's not up to the city to determine what taxes are owed and whether it's not.
But Ms. Hornstra, and truly, I do not know what the outcome of this case is going to be as I sit here. I just don't know. But I will say this. Like my brother, this is a church. And we kind of glossed over the lack of investigation by the city. Don't you think that there is some measure of what we might actually call incompetence, lack of investigation, injustice and laziness, to be perfectly blunt, on the part of the city here?
I would say that, I mean, I'm not sure about injustice, but this was not handled well. I mean, this looks...
And that's why I am sitting here wondering, you know... having sat in the district court and having been able to settle these sort of things, let me just leave it at that. I am really wondering what, you know, has brought us all here. How valuable is that piece of property? How desperately does the city want this church?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, that, you know, there are... Bethel just had every opportunity to assert these claims in state court over a course of many, many years, and hasn't done so. In fact, it was the city's willingness to try to work out a resolution of Bethel with us up until 2003 that has us in the situation that we're in now, where Bethel's using that time against the city, saying that it was strung along. There are jurisdictional obstacles to pursuing, and so while I would like, I could, you know, spend the rest of my time discussing the city's interest in this property, and you know, there are those interests that the city's attorney Mark Gaines testified to at the preliminary injunction hearing, but there's this fundamental jurisdictional problem. There's also, and I won't have very much time to talk about this, but the claims are clearly also barred by the statute of limitations. Bethel.
Well, but there's all statute of limitations. All of this can be told and all that.
Correct.
So there's equitable tolling that might not be applicable here, but. Can you tell me, is the city prepared to say that you would concede that X percentage of this property was properly operating as a church for all this period of time?
Well, I don't want to duck your question. It's not the city's determination to...
Well, what
to
do you think?
But
I mean,
yes,
you guys know
yes.
This case
the property is being used as a church. It's just
90%?
95%? We can't. I mean, we just don't know. What we know is that the Illinois Department of Revenue said that it's in use as a church, it's mostly exempt, but that there's resale activities on the property. If you have no further questions now, I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Norman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. I'd like to start out by addressing the questions that the court raised. I can just get organized here. The district court asked the same questions that two of you have asked, which is why is the city pursuing this pursuing this property, and they never had an answer. There's no answer in the record, so we're left to guess why they're even pursuing this. But it's clear that Judge Duryagian found that this is a poor church, as Your Honor said, a poor church in a violent and desperately poor neighborhood, which is feeding people, which is preaching Jesus to the people who come in the door, which is counseling drug addicts and giving them sports activities and the like. As far as Judge Evans, as far as your question about the resale activities, the in 1999 the Department of Revenue ruled that it was mostly exempt, but that there was a resale activity in the shop. Actually, as a practical matter, this church is 100% exempt, we believe, although there's no ruling to that effect, because the testimony in the record is clear that throughout the period of time the church was operating, that it gave away clothes and furniture and food items to the poor, but they took donations as well. They didn't require any payment, and some people paid more than the village.
Why didn't the church ever get the proper paperwork filed to get a tax exemption?
Your Honor, there was a man named Bowen who represented himself to be the mayor's liaison to the black churches and poor communities.
Right.
He made from 2003 all the way into January of 2006, he was promising that the city would return the deed to our client.
Did he have an office in City Hall?
As far as I know, he was right there in City Hall. In fact, he was connected to the mayor. He, as we understand it, and the record is pretty clear in this, he just reported directly to the mayor. And so basically what happened, and your questions as to the procedure, the city did file an action for possession. Well, first of all, in the meeting of April 30th, 2003, they promised that they would not seek to evict the church. Then, however, later in the year, they began a possession action. However, because the 214-01 proceedings were then going on, they then stopped. So we have had an 8-year status quo until from July of 98 until January of 06, in which the city was basically waiting. And at the same
time, were any of these negotiations, such as they are, as you describe it, Ms. Harkins, were they ever memorialized before the state court proceeding? Would anybody go into the state court and say, we're on hold here because we're negotiating?
They were not memorialized in the court system.
Well, what was then done in the state court system during the period, assuming on the merits you're right on all the exemptions and the like, once you were in the throes of this tax proceeding, what was to prevent the state court from being informed of what you suggest are a holding action?
Well, let me answer your question into two chunks that the state court had a chance to hear about this. In the first case, and by the way, at page 29 of their brief, the city admits there was a federal due process violation in the first part of this case. They've already admitted that, page 29. In the first case, there was no notice whatsoever, and, Your Honors, I'll let you get there unless you can turn.
No, we're used to reading and listening.
Thank you.
And talking.
They were given no notice of the first proceeding, and did not, that 22-5 notice that Your Honor asked about, the record is unequivocal that we did not receive that. And by the way, if I might digress for a second, Judge Duryagian made a specific finding in his preliminary injunction that our witness, who was Bishop Jackson, was extremely persuasive and credible. Those were his words. And also specifically found that the city's witnesses were not credible. And so you should take that into consideration.
Not credible on what point? What witnesses were not credible?
He just said in general. He didn't say on what point.
And who testified at the preliminary hearing on behalf of the city?
There were three or four witnesses. The main witness was a lawyer named Mark Davis who was overseeing the file. And so I think he's specifically referring to Mr. Davis, but there were several other witnesses, too, who were collateral.
Was Mr. Bowen a witness?
That's another point I intended to make. They never even called Mr. Bowen. He's an employee within their control, and they did not put him on the stand. And so under the law in this circuit, it's a fair inference that he had bad testimony for them. So they never brought him in.
He would have been favorable to you under your view, right?
Inference that this court can draw from that is that he would have been favorable to us.
Well, why did you not call Mr. Bowen? It seems to me he's critical. The representations that you suggest he made on behalf of the city.
Yes, Your Honor. We
made of your position.
We did not call him because we got in the case on a Friday, and the case went to trial the following Monday on the preliminary injunction. A temporary restraining order was obtained by Bishop Jackson pro se. And he found us, and we got into the case, and Judge Duryagian said, you're going to trial on the preliminary injunction on Monday. And so we didn't have a chance to call him. But we put on all that testimony. In fact, I was surprised that the city didn't bring
it. Take place?
Over the course of that week, from Monday through Thursday, and I think closing arguments.
Bowen, his office three or four blocks away?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
You had no opportunity to have the city call him?
We were comfortable with the record because it's not our burden because he's within, and I'll just want to emphasize the principles here. We're not responsible to bring him in to make that inference work that he has testimony unfavorable to us. If he's within the control of the city, and that's not disputed, he's an employee, then if they don't bring him in, the inference is that he had testimony bad for them.
So an assistant corporation testified in this case? Is that what occurred?
He's with the Lyons and O'Keefe firm. It's not a corporation counsel technically, although they do all the city's work or the major work, I believe.
And that lawyer was found not credible by the district judge?
Well, he didn't refer by name to Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis was the longest witness. And the most detailed witness, and the one who tried to get an evidence of mailing those letters, by the way, Your Honor, they couldn't even lay a foundation as to whether those letters were mailed, let alone that we received them. And let me, Judge Flom, get back to your question. In the first case, we had no notice. We never got notice, so we couldn't do anything there. In the second case, the only thing that, and we were prejudiced because the only thing that the court would consider was the church's due diligence in not asserting its claims within the two-year statutory period. Because this was an in rem proceeding in the state court, the court had jurisdiction, so we were limited to 2 years. So as a procedural quirk, we could not get in, and we never even reached the merits of our 214-01 petition because both the trial court, Judge Jagielski, and the state appellate court found it had no jurisdiction, and the state appellate court specifically found that Judge Jagielski never even got to the merits of our 214-01 petition. And that's really just like the Peralta case, the Supreme Court case that says a judgment entered without notice or service is unconstitutionally infirm. Failure to give notice violates the most rudimentary demands of due process of law. And we were not allowed to, so the focus of that second proceeding in the state court under 214-01 should have been to get us back into the main case. That's actually what happened in the Texas state courts. They had the same post-judgment collateral attack statute that allowed you to attack a judgment if you prove certain elements. In that case, the floundering point was meritorious defense. But the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, ruled, overruling all the Texas courts, that it's not due process to require him in that collateral attack to prove a meritorious defense because he never got notice.
Does the church now have the proper paperwork demonstrating its tax-exempt status?
We're still in the same situation as we were before. And let me explain, Your Honor. This is a poor church. They don't have a lot of money to hire attorneys. And so all along, they hired an attorney in the state court to take them all the way up to the Supreme Court denying a petition for leave to appeal. They had to pay for that. And then, you know, they're embroiled in this. And I think, Judge Flom, when you talked about tolling, or I think it was you who mentioned tolling, or maybe it was you, Your Honor, but the tolling of limitations, that's a good reason to toll limitations, because they were in the wrong forum. They thought they'd get justice there. They couldn't afford to hire another lawyer to simultaneously come to federal court. So that's sort of where they were stuck.
How complicated is that process?
You go to the department.
I want to get a tax exemption.
It can be very. We do a lot of that work. It can be very complicated. The Department of Revenue.
This has been in operation since '76 or something, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's not like some tax protester.
My partner, Your Honor, just handed me a note. This is Illinois law. As long as the deed shows that the city of Chicago is an owner, Beth, and I was not aware of this, Bethel cannot qualify for an exemption because they're not the owner of the property right now. So the Illinois Department of Revenue will not recognize their rights.
Since 1998, then?
Well, they got an exemption letter, I think it was in 1999. Perhaps they weren't aware that the title had been transferred. But at this point, they're sort of stuck. And so what our hope is to do, and what we are asking Your Honors to do, is to affirm the decision of the district court, allow us to challenge the procedures under due process and also under the First Amendment and several statutes. And also, if we can get the title back in our names, then
now,
we will make sure it gets cleared up.
I would really like to try and understand why the district court was correct in saying that the state court didn't give the church an opportunity to address whether its constitutional rights had been violated. Because, of course, state courts do provide such a remedy.
Yes, ma'am. Well, let me give you the standard that the Supreme Court has set. In order to have what they call a plain, speedy, and efficient remedy, which is essentially the words that govern what you're getting at. In the Rosewell case, the Supreme Court said that there has to be a procedural mechanism that allows for a full hearing and judicial determination at which she may raise any and all constitutional objections. So let me be clear, Your Honor. In the first proceeding, we couldn't raise anything because we didn't have notice of it. In the second proceeding under Section 214.01, when we filed an amended 214.01 petition, the city then made a motion to dismiss. And then the decision ultimately of the trial court was that they could not consider our 214.01 petition until they got to the motion to dismiss. On appeal, the same thing happened. And the court found that it had no jurisdiction because we could not show due diligence why we did not appear in the state court under 214.01 before the 2 years expired.
So you're arguing that Bethel couldn't raise its claim that it was exempt in the state court?
We could not raise any claims. And let me quote to you from the appellate court, if I can find it. The appellate court specifically ruled, and hopefully I can give you the exact quote. No, I'm not finding it, but essentially the appellate court ruled, oh, here it is. The appellate court specifically ruled, and I'm making reference to page 4 of the state appellate opinion. In this case, however, the circuit court did not consider the merits of the church's petition and refused to grant the relief it requested. Instead, the court granted the city's 2-619.1 motion to dismiss, finding that it lacked jurisdiction to consider it. And so, again, Your Honor, we see this as on all fours with the Peralta Supreme Court case.
Your Honor, I don't question that that's an accurate description by the appellate court of what transpired below. But is there anything in the appellate court opinion that precludes an advancement of the due process argument anew?
No, Your Honor.
And could that have been, could you have gone in with your due process argument before a state court at that point, after the loss in the appellate court? And I appreciate the Supreme Court didn't take the case. But
well, you have two questions there. There was nothing that we were able to raise in the appellate court. The opinion basically focused on jurisdiction.
I understand.
And dealing, in fact, they ruled it, they judged it on de novo. On a motion to dismiss standard, not abuse of discretion. They never even got to the 214.
Yeah, but could you raise the very due process arguments that you raise in your federal claim? Could you have raised that?
It's speculation whether if the court had granted the 214.01 petition, we would have been back in the original proceeding, and yes, then they could have been raised if they had granted it. But the problem here under both the Tax Injunction Act and Rooker-Feldman is that the procedural mechanism was such that if you have in rem and you have no notice until after the 2 years, then there's no way to get back in. So we were precluded because, the court dealt only with the motion to dismiss. So we were never able to make the due process or the other federal court claims. We were prohibited
from that. Well, it seems to me your best argument is that equitable estoppel argument.
Your Honor, we have
You have the city lawyer writing to the church telling them that the city will petition the court for an order setting aside the tax sale as a sale in error. But again, in that same letter, the city warns that the church would have to obtain an appropriate exemption for the property.
Yes.
And that's what didn't happen. And that's, we need to know why that didn't happen, particularly because in May 2002, the city told the church, look, get the proper exemption, and said it was going to seek possession immediately. So
yes,
how do we get past that?
Well, let me explain two things. One is that they couldn't get the exemption in 2002 because the title was in the city of Chicago, so they could not do anything to change the exemption status.
Wait, when in 2002?
In
May, the city is saying, get the exemption.
Yes.
But are you saying that prior to May, the city already owned it?
Yes, the city owned it as of July of 1998. They got the tax deed in July of 98. So the church could no longer go in and obtain an exemption after that. So what the city was demanding we do,
It was a legal impossibility?
It was a legal impossibility, yes. It was a practical impossibility, too. Now, as a second matter, let me also point out, though, not only did the city say that they would not proceed against us, once we started, and so I want to make sure that the court understands this, once we brought in the 214.01 collateral attack on the underlying judgment, the city then again stopped from 2003 all the way into January of 06 to allow that process to play out. So the threat in that letter, not only was it a legal impossibility, but also they changed their mind after that. They stopped pursuing that.
Okay, so the city says that at least by 2003, which is when the city began actively seeking possession, right?
That's correct.
The city says that Bethel could not possibly have believed that the city was going to return the title. And that's why, I guess, Bethel filed a petition alleging defects in the tax deed in June of 2003.
Yeah, it was.
And even the district court did agree that reliance after 2003 was unreasonable.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. That's a question.
You don't believe the district court said that, or you don't believe?
I don't believe the district court said that, but also I would say that if that is an issue in the case, it would fall, I believe, under the statute of limitations question, and it's a factual question, which will be decided by the jury in this case once we, God willing, get to that point. So, all I want to do in response to your question, because my time is almost up here, Your Honor, is to just say that the city made it clear after that point in two different ways. Mr. Bowen, again, the testimony is clear through Bishop Jackson that he made repeated promises through January of 06 that it would not be a problem, the church would get the title back, and they didn't have to worry about it. And also the lawyers stopped the possession case. So the possession case just sat dormant from 2003 until 2006.
But you just said January 06.
For when that was the last time Bowen...
Right. Just before the federal lawsuit was filed, though, the church had, I think, what, 7 days or something to vacate.
Yes.
And then it looks like there was an agreement.
There was, Your Honor.
We would vacate by the end of February or something.
It was true. It was.
And why wasn't that just a settlement of this whole dispute?
It was gone
to. And then in February, when that date came and you're supposed to vacate, then the federal court action was filed and the TRO was obtained.
It was traditional, and again, the record is clear on this, and the district court understood it. That is traditional gun to the head, unconscionable or oppression, or whatever the right word is. An agreement which they could not refuse, so to speak, with Luca Brasi standing there. They understood
a lot of agreements that are made when the rubber hits the road. So you figure
the testimony,
that's all we can do. We'll take another 6 weeks here, and then we're going to leave.
Well, they got another 3 weeks, or 4 weeks. But the testimony was unequivocal that they felt they had no choice. And I may have used the wrong language there, and I apologize. But they were stuck.
So you're in better shape if you filed a federal lawsuit right at that moment and got a TRO rather than agreeing to this extra time.
That was the only way they could make they were forced into it. They had no choice other than facing the sheriff coming out and putting all their property on the street, but at least in the heat of that moment, but to agree to something that would give them additional time until February 28th is what they got.
Yeah.
Wait, February 28th of?
2006. And the federal lawsuit was filed on March 1st.
Okay. So When is the last meeting with Bowen?
I don't think it was a meeting. I think they only met once, but there were a number of telephone conversations. The last one, I believe, was between Bishop Jackson and Bowen in January of 06, right before the city went back into court to bring its possession, to reactivate its possession case in the state court. And it was shortly thereafter that they filed the federal court.
I have one more question. Forgive me. This is, when was the first meeting with Bowen?
The first meeting with Bowen was on April 30th of 2003, when the city and church officials got together.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Norman. Ms. Hornstra.
Well, I know I have limited time, so I won't address all of the representations about the record made by Mr. Norman, but I know that the court will scrutinize the record, and I think we make clear in our briefs with reference to the record why equitable estoppel does not apply in this case. Instead, I just have two comments about the 214-01 proceeding and one closing thought about the city's course in this case. First, with respect to the church's due process claim, it wasn't raised in the 214-01 proceeding because it wasn't considered because the church didn't raise it, not because it didn't have an opportunity. The court would have been obligated to hear it had it been raised. Second, the claim that the church couldn't get a tax exemption after 1998 because the city owned it. Bethel's never made that argument before as a reason why it didn't seek this, but it's not true. The Illinois Department of Revenue, it had a basis to seek retroactive exemptions for past tax years. That's what the city was discussing with it doing, and it didn't pursue that. With respect to the city's, actually efforts to seek the property, we have to remember that the Bethel claims that it's 100% exempt, but the Illinois Department of Revenue disagreed when it examined the property in 1999. Bethel didn't challenge that finding. It hasn't otherwise pursued any extra exemptions. And the city doesn't have control over the determination of whether the property is taxable. And the taxes that were owed weren't solely city taxes. They're due to the county for all the taxing districts. Bethel's occupied the property for nearly a decade since the city's owned it. And there are liability issues with the property that the city owns and that it can't occupy. When Bethel tried to set aside the tax deed in state court, it didn't assert the claims that it asserts now. And the suit is simply outside the jurisdiction of the federal courts to set aside. And if it's not a jurisdictional problem, there is clearly a statute of limitations problem. And again, I trust that the record is clear that there were not, in fact, promises after 2003 that the city was going to return the property. The city was trying.
How can the record be clear on that when we have only the bishop's testimony? I cannot understand why Mr. Bowen wasn't called.
I can actually address that. Bishop Jackson, and one thing, his testimony is nothing about any promises. It's Mr. Bowen talked about the possibility the city would give the property back. He doesn't testify at all that Bowen promised it. The reason Bowen wasn't called was that Bishop Jackson was actually, the testimony about Bowen didn't come out until Bishop Jackson's rebuttal testimony. He had full testimony the first day of the hearing. Then he was called a rebuttal witness, and it wasn't rebutting anything. It was for the first time Bowen was mentioned on the very last day of the preliminary injunction hearing after the city had already called its witnesses and put on its case. So it was the city that didn't have an opportunity to rebut the testimony about what Bowen had testified.
Did the city request from Judge Duryagin the opportunity to call Mr. Bowen to rebut?
It didn't at that point. The city did object to Bishop Jackson's testimony on that point because it wasn't rebutting anything, and that objection was overruled. But the district court judge made clear that the hearing was finished.
Well, if you don't ask the district court.
Correct, on that point in particular. But the main thing is that Bishop Jackson didn't testify about any promises, so there really wasn't anything that needed to be rebutted because his testimony wasn't clear. All you had were Bowen said the city might be willing to work something out at the same time that the city was seeking possession. It sought possession in 2003, and the only reason, Bethel represented as the city stopped seeking possession, but it was stayed from doing so.
What's
during...
What's the property being used for today?
Bethel still occupies it.
And what's the plan for the property?
The city's witness at the preliminary injunction testimony, and I realize my time is up, but I want to answer your questions.
I'm doing this to you.
Okay. The city's witness at the preliminary injunction hearing testified there were some thoughts about using it for housing. Of course, the city doesn't have possession at this point. It can't make any plans because we don't know when, this will be wrapped up, and the city hasn't had access for other than cursory inspections to figure out what the property would be suitable for.
When you say cursory inspections, can't building inspectors go in any time?
They have gone in to inspect for building code violations, but there has to be a reason for that. We can't go in just because we want to check out the property and see. Certainly the church would say that was harassment at this point if we were just trying to figure out what we want to do with the property when we get it. But there were discussions of using it for affordable housing in the neighborhood. I think Mr. Gaines testified there had been some discussions about using it for some light manufacturing, although I could be wrong about that being in the record. That may be something that came up before. But there are no definite plans. The city just hasn't been in a position to make plans when it doesn't have possession of the property.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement.